excited today. Very excited. Lindsay Rollins here on our another COVID edition of the podcast. I'm excited today because A, Lindsay is going to be hosting, I think, an important podcast, which is the Women of War podcast. The reason I think, of course, it's important is that I really want, especially women who have been in combat, I really want their perspective. And actually, Lindsay and I, you and I will talk about interesting stories about women in combat, because I still have one of my favorite all-time stories. I won't say her name, but one of the best stories out there that just show you that the argument, this age-old argument that these ridiculous Cold War antiquated men keep making about why we shouldn't be together is actually ridiculous, because I have an incredible, my favorite story of all time about that particular item. But so I'm excited to talk to Lindsay a little bit about that, but I also want everyone to kind of get to know her as well, you know, especially Captain Rowland herself, kind of her background, what she's done, things of that nature, and currently where she is now. I mean, she, your resume is incredible. I do like, you know, the things that you're doing, you know, everything on the Hill, and then, of course, your military background. So, ladies and gentlemen, before I get started, I just want to say, everybody, the incredible Lindsay Rowland's here.
Hello. Thank you for having me on your podcast.
No, you're welcome. And again, thank you for joining us in this unique time. I think, like you said it before we started, I think one of the better things was the fact that, you know, more people are, it's easier to do this now. And now that we kind of got the technical setup all the way it should be, we can get more guests and get more people to tell their story, because I think it's important that they understand that we're putting out this information, right? Because, you know, I just think it's just, in this time, it's, we want to give more people a little bit more hope. With that being said, I really want to kind of start with you, right? I want to start with basically, when I ask most people this, you joined after 9/11 happened, right?
No, and, I didn't.
Oh, you didn't? Okay, good. When did you start? You started 2005, or you were prior to that?
Well, so I did ROTC, so I was already locked into a contract where I was going active duty and commissioning afterwards, after my college time. So I don't really see myself as post 9/11. I see myself as having committed prior to 9/11.
So that's a good, then that actually goes to my second question, because that's what I was going to ask you. Because most of the time, and the people I've been talking to over the last couple of weeks has been, I always want to know what's the driver to service. So you're not a post 9/11 one. So did you have family that served? Did you have a grandfather or a grandmother that was in the, you know, World War II, Korea, Vietnam? Anything like that happened, or was there no service in your family prior?
No, there was no service. And what happened is I told my mother and father that I wanted to enlist when I was in high school. Mm. And they were like, absolutely not. You're going to college.
Right.
So my mother started like infiltrating my like mind with ROTC and college and how we could both attain our goals at the same time. And so at that time, they were throwing ROTC scholarships out. Like, you could, as a woman, they were recruiting women. Everybody had scholarships. I did some time at Ohio University. I got a full ride. And ended up leaving there and transferring to Hawaii Pacific University, got a full ROTC ride there. So at that time, it was, I don't want to say they weren't selective, but I want to say that they were definitely recruiting women.
That's interesting. So was there a regret that you didn't go enlisted, or you were like, you know, this was good, I'd be just starting the commission side? Just out of curiosity.
I didn't know any difference.
You didn't know the difference at the time. Okay. Yeah. So I would say for me, just real quick, because I was like, it's not, I'm just trying to do, compare, I'm doing a baseline. Like when I did, because I was a complete opposite, right? You want to talk about who the fuck knows what happened with me. I had a college degree and then I joined as enlisted. So think about that. So I went to college first, graduated. I got completely suckered by Staff Sergeant Philip Tirado. I'll say your name every time, recruiter, because you lied to me. I love you, though, because you got me in the Army, but damn, don't tell me those lies. And I've heard some really great lies recently in some of these podcasts, like incredible, like bullshit lies that recruiters tell people to get them to sign up. So that's been a kind of a recurring theme. But I remember specifically saying to him, like, hey, I got a college degree, because I joined in 99. So, like, I didn't know. Like, Google was, like, at the advent. I think I had Netscape, actually. Like, I was dial-up fucking modem shit. I was like, what's going on? So I really know what to look for. And I remember going in there, and the first thing he said to me was, hey, go piss in this cup. That's the first thing he said to me. And he goes, if you pass the drug test, then I'm going to keep talking to you. And I'm like, all right, fair enough. Let's go. Did it. 5 minutes later, he goes, okay, what do you want to do? And I'm like, well, what do I want to do? It's actually pretty simple. I want to join the Army. I don't know. Like, I don't know what else I want to do. Like, what do I do? Like, because I didn't know there was MOSs. I'm like, do I join? Like, what do I, like, but he got me because I remember on the wall, I never forget this, like on the right side or whatever. I remember sitting there and I was like, what's a non-commissioned officer mean? Because he had like his NCO like diploma thing up from his PLD, not from PLDC, but like he was from BNOC. And I was like looking at his BNOC diploma and it said non-commissioned officer. I'm like, hey, how do I become a non-commissioned officer? Or how do I become an officer? And then he said it. He goes, well, there's a difference between a non-commissioned officer and an officer and a commissioned officer. I go, well, what's the difference? He goes, well, one has a college degree and they go through this. And I'm like, well, why can't I do that? I have a college degree. He goes, no, that's not how it works. I go, oh, what do you mean? He goes, well, first, how it works is you got to go to your unit. You got to be at least 2 years as an enlisted person. And then you have to apply to go to officer candidate school and you'll pass. And I'm like, oh, really? And I'm like, okay, so what do I do now? He goes, hey, you're just going to go take the ASVAB and then we'll figure it out from there. You know, now if I had if the Army had a more robust, you know, website back for 99, I would immediately have known that, you know, you just go through and like, so when I went to OCS, I had guys that just went to basic training and then they went to OCS. They came in with the college degree.
Well, you could have done a direct commission, right?
But no, I went through the other way. Now there's no regrets because I had a great time being enlisted. Oh, it was my fun. Everyone wants to bitch and moan about the barracks. The barracks are great. Oh my God, what a great time. When you had safety brief done 16:30 on a Friday, forget it. I mean, it was a disaster. It's between 1700 and then first call on Monday into PT formation, forget it. Like everything was a blur. It was one of the best times ever. So I think it's interesting. That's why I was asking, was that like, what was your background into it? Because I always like to see how people got into the service. And then what they, you know, they were feeling about it. So that's interesting to me is that's the background that you had taken. So kind of take me through that. Then you get your commission and then where do you go from there?
So I got my undergrad in journalism.
Okay.
And I was commissioned. And because at that time I wanted to be an MP.
Okay.
Which, thank goodness, that branch was not recruiting at the time, but transportation was the big one. They needed to recruit officers into transportation.
Yeah.
And what did I know about what branch I wanted? I had no idea. I was like waiting tables in Hawaii, going to school, partying. Right. I mean, I didn't know. So I ended up going transportation. And I will tell you kind of like your story, it was probably the best branch I could have been in.
Right.
It was a branch where I was able to think outside of the box and do cool missions and just really always in crisis mode constantly. But I found that to be the new norm. And I love the transportation branch.
So you were thrown into the fire then essentially, right? Because if you were transportation in Iraq in 07, I mean, the surge was there. I worked counter ID 0607 on the ground in convoy. So if you were a transpo officer, oh my God, we actually probably crossed paths at one point, not even knowing it, but I can't even imagine. Tell me a little bit about your time running convoys in your 07, 09 timeframe.
Well, so back it up a little bit. I did my, you know, my career course, and then I was stationed in Germany right away. Mannheim, Germany, Coleman Barracks. We were there for a year, and then we deployed to Iraq, which is a little bit before the surge, because we ended up getting caught up in the surge at the end and added the extra 3 months at the end.
Okay.
So we got there, and I guess my new title is now Convoy Security Commander.
Awesome.
I mean, you know, whatever, transportation, we can do anything.
Right.
But I will tell you, it was probably the best time, not only in my military career, but probably in my life. Because I had the best platoon.
Okay.
And then we were broken down into squads, and we ran convoys by squads. And I will tell you, the time that I spent there with my soldiers and my guys was absolutely amazing. We functioned as a team like I've never seen a team function since I've left the military.
What were you running? You were just running like, were you running the security around, let's just say, not like HETs or anything like that? You were just running, who were you running on your convoys?
So we had 915s and then we were running line haul and whites.
Okay, yeah. Oh, yeah. So that you were busy.
Yeah. So we were actually stationed in Erifjan, but we ran convoy security all through Iraq. So I got to see when people talk about Iraq where they were stationed, I'm always like, well, I was stationed in Kuwait, but not really.
No, because you have to cross at Navistar every day.
Exactly. And I think they changed it. They changed the name from Navistar to something else by the time I got there. It was okay. K Crossing.
Yeah, K Crossing. Yeah, actually, yeah, K Crossing. Because you would go, because Safwan Village was right across before you hit the Cloverleaf, and then you would dip up, you would go straight up. I remember that. And they used to hide under the bridge, I remember, in that Cloverleaf by Safwan. So you go through shitty Safwan, which reminded me of Tatooine and Star Wars. And then, I think it does it, right? They were like the hijacker's paradise, right? And yeah, and I remember that. And then you hit the Cloverleaf, and then you shot up Tampa, and then, you know, I think you're next to Wheel, and then you hit, I think Iskandaria was up there, and then you were getting up closer to Biop and Victory and stuff like that. And then either you split north, you go down, you know, that's where you start map Irish to Michigan and stuff like that to go west. I remember all that. But so that's the one thing I want to bring up though, which is interesting because that was a dangerous time. I don't care who you were, you out on those roads. That was a really, really fighting, ridiculous, stressful, dangerous time for everybody.
It was. And a lot of times I would get fired. Like I would be on mission and get into fights with like 82nd about rolling by my convoys fast or with the Australian, whatever they were on the bridges. I would get into fights. And so by the time I came back from mission, this was like a little bit later in my time in Iraq, I would get fired. And then I would be put on probation for like 2 or 3 days. And then they'd be like, okay, we got a mission for you and you're good at this. So we're going to unfire you.
Right, right.
And I would remind them that they fired me only to get the little. And then I would always get the conversation like, here's the box. Here's right. Lindsay Rowland. She's always outside. And I was a lieutenant. She's always outside of the box just a little. We could get her inside the box. So we always had this box analogy about my leadership. And I would tell my soldiers about it. And they thought it was hilarious.
Right.
But so we're always working on getting me inside the box. But I probably ran, and not to give myself, you know, credit, but I probably ran the most convoys at that time out of any platoon leader and probably platoon sergeants at that time. Because when I got back to Kuwait, I could not sit still.
Of course. Right.
I mean, I would send my soldiers to the pool. Right. We would, you know, eat whatever fast food was there. But then it's like, it's time to go again.
See, and that's, I think that's, so let's talk about that because that's an interesting point. And I think people, I talk about this with Pasha. And I think, you know, Pasha is doing, he's heading up and he's helping out with the Smashing the Stigma podcast for PTSD. Because Pasha was one of the ones, he was in 05, 06 tour, and then he was actually 14, 15. His 05, 06 tour, he had a VBID suicide bomber hit him, direct on. He survived. Wow. Yeah, wow. And actually, there's video. So Al-Qaeda in Iraq was, you know, because they were setting up on the roads, and that was their fucking thing with their little video cameras. And there's video. I've seen the video. It's an incredible video. I'll show you one day. The guy comes up. He's in his fucking shitty, I think it was a station wagon, actually. You could see it in the video. Pasha's running a counter ID. He was working a counter ID convoy. They were going out to do a mission. And you see the vehicle start to come over and it's going to ram them. And you see Pasha, who couldn't get the turret over at time, grab his M4 and just start lighting the driver up. Shoots him, he doesn't know how many times, but you could kind of count. It's at least, he probably puts an entire magazine into the guy. And then probably about, this is all within 30 seconds it happens, right? And then you see the detonation go off and it's nothing. I mean, it's all blank, huge explosion. And somehow, I don't know, maybe it's just the way the IEDs were seated or whatever the way it was. I mean, they get hurt, but nobody dies, right? So yeah, he's helping out with that part with you know, he talks a lot about that with PTSD. And then of course his next thing what was more incredible was, and there's actual picture of it too. He gets out, this is years after his last tour. He goes back to Iraq, walking up, count, there's an ID call, right? You know, he does his 5 and 25, he's looking around. And then he kneels down to see, because someone had called it, there's an ID. And within that second, he said he remembers kneeling down, looking over, and it was just, I don't know how many days he changed, what's it called, were there. I forgot, right? So there was so many daisy chained IEDs that go off, and then somehow he survives. So he lived. He was completely covered, and he was out of it. That was they medevaced him, and that was the end of his tour, right? So he was done there. But yeah, so for him, that was it was an interesting time. But what I'd like to tell people is, so he had two IED attacks to survive that were direct. But what I like to tell people, what you know when you said you were excited, is that I think a lot of people, especially civilians, don't remember this part, was how ridiculous the physiological aspect of what we had to do with counter IED was, and running convoys. Because you're going down the road, I don't care if your warlocks are, even if the warlock or the dukes are up, you got the roller in the front.
If they're up, right?
If they're up, if it's not jamming my fucking radio somehow, right? And I can't get goddamn comms, and I got to...
And if my 50 cal didn't rust at the top, you know, rust and not misfire at the firing pit, you know?
Right, think about all the things, but we have all that going on, and now we got a spot, right? So we're spotting everything. So we're moving down the road, depending on what you're protecting. I was in most of my missions, I was integrated into the convoys. But yeah, we're looking at TTPs, we're looking at everything. But people don't realize what that was like. That I always, and that sign that always stood out there for me was, is today the day, right? Because it would fuck with you so bad. Because that was true, like mentally thinking that, you know, is your weapon red or your comms good? And then the last sign before you left the wire was, is today the day? And I think people like yourself and other people ran those convoys, and that's why you said you had so much energy and you were like, you know, why we acted the way we were was, I mean, dude, we'd have to go maybe 22 clicks. That fucking route goes black. We're going to be on that thing for 18 hours. And who the hell knows if there's some command wire IED and some guy 180 feet sitting there behind a fucking brush waiting to hit you, or an EFP, or if it's a victim operated or a pressure plate or anything along those lines. And that's every day, right? Before we even get to where our final mission was. Just think about that. That's a secondary effect of an attack, essentially, right? But it was constant. And I think that's one of the important things that people should know, especially about you. You lived it, right? More than anything else. And I think people should pay a little bit more homage, especially even, doesn't matter, man or woman, that's a tough job. And I don't know why people have to recognize that that transpo, that person who was doing counter ID, man, I don't care what it was. It's just like you're walking through like the booby trap jungles of Vietnam, essentially, because we never know where it was going to be, regardless of those intel reports.
Well, 2 points on that. Number one, I never tell people about my experience because I don't really give a fuck what they think. And I feel like when I explain it to them, it doesn't come out anywhere near the reality. And I was so high on Rippets and cigarettes and everything that sometimes I don't remember it. So my I stopped telling stories. And second point, to what you were talking about earlier. So I remember getting leave time, right? Because I think we got like 2 or 3 weeks at that time.
Yeah.
And I was dating this guy because I was in Germany and he had taken a platoon leader position in Italy in Vicenza. So I went to visit him for my leave and I came back off leave early because I knew my guys had gone out with somebody that wouldn't let them smoke in the trucks. Wouldn't let them go to the pool because there was a couple pools on some of our bases that we stopped at. Wouldn't let my guys, he like basically put my guys on lockdown. And so they were emailing me and telling me all about it. And I was like, oh, hell no.
Right.
Because I was worried they were going to die.
Yeah.
I mean, I know their moves. I knew when, you know, his wife wasn't speaking to him or when my driver decided to do steroids and his butt was all swollen from injecting steroids in his ass. And I know, you know, I knew how to deal with that.
Right.
And my company commander would write me and be like, they're all fucked up. Things are all fucked up. And I'm like, and I'm sure they were probably fine.
Right.
But it was just, I couldn't sit in Italy drinking wine and eating pasta knowing that this was going on. So I came back early from my leave, and not to give myself credit for that, but I was just so relieved to get back. And then I had to wait for them to come up convoy to come back, and then I had to wait to listen to them bitch about everything so that we could now focus on the next mission. But I just remember being at a heightened state of arousal for 15 months.
Right. And then coming back, what was that transition like for you? Similar?
Well, so I had all this money.
Yeah.
I had another year in Germany. I pretty much got drunk for a year. and travel to Europe.
Yeah, well, that's a good. It's a good recovery.
Yeah, I got moved to some lame job in the S2 shop.
Right.
We were deactivating all those companies in Germany, like 101 and 109th. And I was part of deactivation and just like lame shit. And I remember even going on leave and not even telling my supervisor I was on leave. And she's like, "Where are you?" And I'm like, "I'm in Bulgaria." I basically used all my money during that time to travel because I just needed to escape.
Yeah. And then, so from that point on, what was left in your career though? Cause you fast forward, you left in what, 2015?
Mm-hmm. So I'm even trying to remember because sometimes it's a blur. So right. I came back to the States, went to Virginia, did my career course time. And then I was assigned to 10th Mountain Division.
Okay.
And it just so happened that my college roommates, in Hawaii, I posted on Facebook, "Hey, I'm going to 2nd Brigade, 10th Mountain," because at that time I did Facebook. I don't anymore. And she wrote me back, "That's my dad's brigade."
No kidding.
Yeah. So wow. it was Colonel David Miller. And so I was just really excited that I landed in his brigade. And at the time, that was the most deployed brigade in the Army. I'm not sure, you know, what the stats are now. But I was very happy to be there. And I spent the next 4 years probably under the best leadership I've ever had.
Really?
Yeah. So I'm also in that story, I'm the Bradley Manning Brigade.
Oh, no. Wait. So after or when it's happening?
So I was at Bob Hammer when he got arrested.
Are you kidding me? Mm-hmm. So you were there.
Yeah. So I remember is that there was a helicopter that came in, took somebody away. There was a briefing from God knows who about there's something happened last night, whatever. And then we turned on the news.
Right. And listen, not for nothing, I do remember that was a funnier thing. Like every computer had a USB port and like a CDR, like you could burn like every super computer. And it's like, oh, yay, there are, you know, you can literally plug any USB drive in. I remember going in and grabbing the reports from like Sexy and like the Jaedo folks all the time. And like you'd go in the dungeon in Faw and out, you know, in the Outfall Palace, there was that S2 dungeon they used to have. We'd go there and I used to pick up reports, and then there was like a separate place, the Navy. It was like a big Navy presence too under the Sexy guys, the Combined Explosive Exploitation Cell. And I remember laughing and thinking to myself, this is a fucking super computer. And like there was like five or six like USB ports on the front of it. And like, you know, and then we're like TCN's cleaning the fucking like the thing. I'm like, what is this insane? Like, but I mean, I'm not saying what he did was wrong or whatever. I just think it's always funny that, you know, we practice so much about ops at the time that you gave literally the easiest way in the world to take whatever you wanted, or anybody for that matter, not even a soldier, but there were people that moved through those facilities all the time. And you know, the people that were supposed to watch them, you know, you always have somebody assigned. It was like some PFC. He's like, I don't give a fuck, right? He's smoking and joking. No one's paying attention.
Well, so he was on night shift, and one of my good friends was the lieutenant in charge, but of course she worked days. I mean, he was working in the brigade talk, and she's like, we just left him alone. We did. I mean, he did his job. I think he was using Lady Gaga CDs, if I remember correctly.
Okay.
I don't want to go into all those details, but So that deployment was actually, I was a general supply officer. So I was doing lame shit. And we came back then shortly after the Bradley Manning thing. And then of course we were on lockdown with our USB drives, no USB drives, no share portal.
Right.
Basically don't even talk into the computer.
Yeah.
And then they started going after some of my friends for like, you know, it just turned into like a witch hunt.
No kidding. Mm-hmm. No kidding. Yeah. And then we know what the end result of it all was. But it's interesting. Wow. What a small world. You were with them in that. I remember that whole thing. Oh my goodness gracious.
And I was so pissed because that colonel, David Miller, he lost his career, obviously. And so I told you I had a personal connection with him, and that really bothered me. And even that lieutenant, it took her probably, she was on lockdown at Fort Drum, I think, for a year and a half after that before they would clear her to go to her next duty station. So that really hit our brigade hard. And of course, at the time they were doing great things. So it was just kind of a misrepresentation of 2nd Brigade to the Mountain. So that kind of was definitely disturbing.
You know, it's interesting too, if you want to draw a line, right? Look at Abu Ghraib. I mean,
right?
Like if you think about what happened there, so this was one person's actions, it's fucking the whole company up. You can't look, Abu Ghraib was multiple people up and down the lot. I mean, not even that. It was contractors involved. It was all kinds of shit. Like, we all know what happened with CACI, with the interrogator thing, you know, all the things that they were doing. And then look at what happened with what one person does. I don't think we handle our shit right. I mean, it's just, it's a shame, like you said, to see that happen like that.
Well, and also, he was a black infantry guy. And at that time, it was very rare for them to be in. He was going to be a general. And people were excited because, you know, he was really good at his job and he was, you know, kind of, you know, hedging out a future that a lot had not had before. So it was just really sad to see his career. And I'm sure he's doing great things now, but he's not a general and that's what he was destined to be.
Yeah, because you know that too, especially because if you're putting that much time in, let's be honest with ourselves. And Nick, you said they're prepped up to be a general and they want to be that general. Give me a break. And then you're going to fuck them because of somebody that's so far removed. I mean, let's be honest with ourselves. I mean, we're talking about so far removed from one individual on a night shift. You're going to destroy this person's career. It's fucked up.
Well, and also one more note on that, because you can see this still bothers me, is that he was forced to deploy everybody. So everybody came up with excuses why they couldn't go on that deployment.
Okay.
Because they had just gotten back from a deployment. You know, there was the dwell time and everything, but so people that came down with mental health issues, they were deploying anyways, because don't give me that fucking bullshit. You got a mental health issue, right? So he was told to take all those people. Like, he was directed to do that. So in a way, he didn't have a choice. And of course, I'm defending him. But, you know, at that time, going to mental health was not going to save you from that deployment.
That's interesting too, because I mean, were there indications at the time? Oh, it's the fucking army, right? I mean, that's
they say that he had gone to mental health and he was having issues with his. We know the issues.
Yeah.
And he had gone, but he was one of those ones like, man up, you're going, stop being a little bitch.
See, talk about independence, like lines of failure, right? Because then let's do the one thing. So they know there's pre-existing potential issues, right? Which it happens to everybody. Everybody, listen. Fucking how many years of war we're into, and especially if you're doing those kind of goddamn tours, forget it, right? I don't care what anybody says, it's fucking rough.
Right.
And then they're gonna be like, you know what? I know the best thing we're gonna do. Let's leave this person completely alone at night. Yeah, it's a good idea. You know what? We're not even gonna check. Let's throw them on a 12-hour shift in a fucking dungeon, essentially. And we're like, you know what? Things will be fine. Don't worry about it. So, and then, you know what? It's everyone's fault. I mean, give me a break. That's a little fucking... I didn't know all that. That's a fucking terrible, Jesus Christ. What a terrible story. That I didn't realize that. That's a really, people take that part of it out too, especially when there was warning signs. That's a problem. That's really bad. Especially, and they fucked that general, I mean, the colonel out of it. That's even worse too, because really think about it. So they're forcing someone to go do someone. They indicated that there were already problems and then like, don't worry, everything will be fine. We're not going to check on them.
Right, and
it's crazy.
The colonel is directed, you know, by hire, fill that MTO. That MTO needs to be filled. So don't go down range with, you know, a certain percentage of soldiers missing.
You know what's ridiculous about that too, if you really think about it, you could have fucking pulled somebody else in. Especially if there were indicators of somebody having an issue and things of that nature, they could have done it. Now, I'm not blaming that one individual, but they could have been like to fill the MTO. They could have absolutely figured out. I don't care what anybody's saying. Dude, they met their goals. They had fucking felons coming in with waivers, for Christ's sake. You know what I mean? Let's be honest with what was going on in the Army at the time. There was some bad shit going on. I mean, even look at Bo Bergdahl's platoon and some of the assertions that were thrown around with the drug use and all the other stuff at the time. I've witnessed it myself, right? I know you've probably seen the same shit. We've seen what the motherfuckers are doing just to cope with what those kind of... You know, people want to talk, and this is the one thing, now you got me kind of on a roll here. People want to talk shit, right? They want to talk about certain things. You know, I'm not knocking it, but just like you do, I got a buddy that has done 10 deployments. I mean, and we've been at war for fucking almost 20 years now. And they weren't easy deployments either. He said he had one or two, but he was like the, at one point he was with the 75th. You know, he's done all kinds of shit, right? He was a door kicker. He did all things. And then, like, you know, he took his, as he grown in his rank, he took like an S2 position and things like that, but still 10 deployments. I mean, give me a break. And then they want to know what's going on with how people are doing. Look how people came back fucked up from Vietnam and they did three or two or one for that matter. But we're going to stick people on 10 times and then wonder why. Oh, I can't believe there's a problem with mental health in this country. Like, what, are you fucking kidding me? You're going to put somebody through the meat grinder 10 times and see what happens?
Well, and on that point with Chelsea Manning or Bradley Manning, you had three brigades. You know, that was, there was three brigades there and a sustainment brigade that you could have chosen from.
Exactly. So you couldn't pull somebody back, especially if somebody exhibited that there were some issues with that. And that wasn't like 2006 or seven, right? You know what I mean? Like, we weren't like starting to figure out, all right, we fucked up, like things are going sideways. We really need a lot of help. This was deep in the war and they could have pulled people into that, right? I mean, there were bodies, a lot of bodies. And really what was so special about his specialty that he needed to be there? Except that, listen, you put somebody on night shift, you already know. It's like battle captains at night, right? The officers, they don't give a fuck about officers. If you're a night shift battle captain, you know what I mean? They had no other use for you except for that I need a warm body in there to answer the phone.
Right. He was like a specialist, if I remember. He wasn't.
Yeah. No, it's insane. Okay. I mean, we're on a thing, but wow, what a weird fucking tie-in, right? That you were there when that happened. That's a piece of history too, right? No kidding. No, yeah. My biggest, I mean, our claim to fame was we were on the,
Well, wait, I would not call that a claim to fame.
Well, it's still in our circle, it is essentially, okay. Right? Because, I mean, so did you, out of curiosity, at any point do you ever remember running into him?
No, I will say that I probably ran into him in dying facilities. I probably ran into him in Drum, but
right.
I never met remember. Him, yeah. So no.
Yeah, same thing. I think I flew over on the plane with Jessica Lynch. She was on my manifest. Yeah. I still have a copy of the manifest and all the ones that were killed in the 507th were on that plane. I look back at it. So I thought that was creepy. And then the weird thing is, I know we're way off topic now, but years later, this is the fucking craziest thing. I was already out of the military. And I was working as I was a defense contractor before I started my business. And I was on, I went to, I had to do a site meeting out in West Virginia in Morgantown.
And she lives near there.
I was in the hotel at the fucking Radisson and I'm sitting downstairs. I don't know what I was waiting for, but I was like sitting downstairs after breakfast. And lo and behold, I look up and I'm like, that's fucking, and she's still on crutches. And yeah. I was like, holy shit. I'm like, that's Jessica Lynch. And I went up to her and I said, hey, you know, I just want to say hello. I go, I know we're not going to remember, but we were a part of, we pulled your vehicles actually, because our group were the ones that pulled her vehicles out that were still on fire.
Wow.
Yeah, we went in and we grabbed her. So we were with, because we were with Task Force Tarwood with the Marines when we did the march up. And we had to go get those vehicles back. And we, with wreckers, went in while the Marines did basically like a feint kind of thing and like engaged the population on one side of the town. And we fucking pulled those vehicles and most of them were still on fire. And I do remember that. And I told her, I'm like, I remember that. And then we did the march up with the 2-8 afterwards. But yeah, no, small world. But I remember that was like those weird little claims of like fame from military history that we have.
But that was a huge deal. Jessica Lynch, yeah. I mean, I remember reading the book. I wasn't actually active duty at the time, but that was huge, that story. And of course, she came out later with what really happened, but I've always very, very much admired her.
Yeah, you know what? People want to say that she never fired anything. Let me tell you something. Everyone wants to talk shit until they're in that situation. Exactly. They were in a fucking nightmare buzzsaw. She was just driving a vehicle and her commander, you know, fucking made to this day, I don't know what, I mean, we know the report. Commander waved to the guy on the bridge. She was not supposed to even go with the Nazaria. And then they made that was the decision. That was the end all, was they get out of the town. And then for whatever fucking reason, they turn back and go back through. And that was just like, we were sitting, I'll never forget this. We were sitting, they drove past us. We'll never forget this, the day we forget. We're like, where the fuck? I remember looking at someone, I'm like, where the fuck are they going, right? And they drove past us. And we're like, do we not know something we're supposed to know? And like, we had tanks and shit, because we were the Marines. And it was just a bunch of fucking maintenance vehicles and like 5 tons and 2.5s. And I'm like wreckers. And I'm like, where are they going? And I'm like, oh shit. And then maybe, I don't remember the time, right? But it was a short period of time later, that town erupts. Like, we think they were shooting at us at one point. And we're like, holy shit, it's like the 4th of July. And then we caught up with the three vehicles, which was the three Humvees that coming out. It was the company commander and the two people behind him. And he was frantic. He's like, oh my God, we're, you know, I don't remember what he was saying, but the Marines were like, there, blah, blah, blah. And everybody was freaking out. And we got that word later on, maybe an hour or two later, to go in and grab the vehicles that we could grab. And we went in, and it was like haste too, very hastily. And I remember grabbing those, our maintenance platoon went in and grabbed the vehicles, the wreckers. And it was fucking bizarre time.
Anyway. Yeah, so many things to say about that, but yes, definitely. That was and then she lost her best friend, I believe, too.
Yeah, Lori. That was a sad thing. I mean, so people could talk all the shit they want. It wasn't her fault. She adapted the situation. She had time to do anything too. She got into a car wreck and she was unconscious, right? I mean,
right.
Anybody can say whatever they want, but it's the fucking idiots that have never done anything. And understand that was a complete shit show that went went down so far and so fast. Like, it was quick. Like, it wasn't, I remember from the timing, from when we heard the first, like, we heard a couple rounds go off, and then it was just like, you know, like we're watching the 4th of July go off, right? And it was like quick. And then it was everything, but it was minutes, right? So if anything, they could say whatever they want. She had no time. And nobody knew. I mean, it was like almost like Somalia in a sense, where they're going through a small town where you have, you know, there's buildings on all sides, and they're driving through very small streets, and there was nothing they could do but to try to get out of it, right? So the fact that she survived is even more insane. And both her legs were crushed. I mean, mm-hmm. Like massively disfigured, crushing.
She was in a wheelchair for a long time, wasn't she?
Yeah, she was. And then, like I said, we're talking about, if you really want to think about it, so that happened in 03. I saw her in 08. 5 years later, she was still on crutches.
Aww.
Yeah. So people want to talk shit. And not only she was on crutches, if I remember, and this might be hazy, I think she still had like those boots on.
She did. You know what I mean? Yeah. She had something wrong with her foot.
Yeah. She had like a boot. I remember that specifically. I remember seeing like the boots were on. And she was wearing Negro civilian clothes. Like, she was going to class, she told me, because she was going to West Virginia University at the time. But I specifically remember her saying, you're still recovering. She goes, yeah, I'm still recovering. And that was an interesting thing. So for her, I think she got a bad rap. I don't know why. You know, what those people went through that day were incredible. It's all from the actions of one person who really fucking, you know, whatever. You could. The after action report says it all. Anybody wants to dispute my opinion, that's fine. But people can go read the redacted one. Just Google 507th Maintenance Company report online, and you will see a redacted copy of exactly what happened. Not even remotely her fault. And she did exactly what she was supposed to do. She was just in a shit situation.
Agreed.
Yeah. But that kind of brings me back to you now. So you're done with the great story, by the way, with Chelsea Manning. That's an interesting thing. So that brings us to, you're like, you know what? It's the Army has decided that they're going to medical retirement. They're going to say it's time, it's over. What is that how that happens, or what happens in that time of transition?
Oh, so we have so much more story to tell.
And all right,
I'll keep it quick because I don't really like to talk about myself. But so I did a command at Fort Drum. They were getting ready to deploy to Afghanistan. I was there for, I think, 3 or 4 years, did a command, had an SFAT team underneath me, was getting them ready to deploy.
Right.
They all went to Afghanistan. I don't know if you remember Colonel Clark. who was killed, and I forget what, where in Afghanistan, but it was friendly fire. Someone came in and opened fire and killed Colonel Clark, Major Leonard.
Oh, yeah. Now I know exactly what you're talking about. Yeah.
Okay, so it was the Helmand province. Mm-hmm. So I had applied for FAO, Foreign Area Officer, yeah. And I really wanted to do it. I applied for Civil Affairs, and I had gotten accepted, but I was like, I want to be a FAO.
Yeah.
During my time traveling back during my traveling time, I had gone to Istanbul a lot. I had a friend that was a FAO, and that's what I wanted to do. I was like, I did all this crazy shit. Let me do something that I want to do now. And I applied for FAO, and then my brigade commander talked to FAO, and they're like, we need her for another command. Can we keep her for another year? FAO was like, that's fine. So now we're getting ready to go to Afghanistan, and they're like, we want you to come. They needed a female on that SFET team with Colonel Clark. And FAO said, if she doesn't come to FAO now, we are going to drop her.
Okay.
So I made a tough decision, and I went to FAO. And, of course, you can imagine all the emotions that go with leaving your company or leaving. And then my battalion command ended up getting relieved, and that's a whole nother story. So I went to FAO, was PCS to the Defense Language Institute.
Okay.
And I got picked up for German.
Oh, well.
And I started taking German there, and I couldn't pass German.
Okay.
So I'm dealing with what's going on with Colonel Clark. I'm dealing with an investigation for a sexual assault that I didn't apparently investigate correctly as in my command time. I'm dealing with sitting in a classroom now, you know, because I'm still hyped up. And I'm dealing with sitting in a classroom now for 7 hours a day trying to learn German.
Yeah.
The Navy commander in my class, I'm talking about five people in the class, refuses to let me smoke because he can't stand the smell of smoke when I come back in from my breaks. So I can't smoke. I just got a company command where I'm like running like 100 people, right?
Right.
Now I can't smoke.
Right.
I'm on lockdown. I'm in this small classroom. I'm going fucking crazy, right? And so long story short, I couldn't pass the listening part of German. And they kept telling me, we're going to kick you. Not FAO didn't tell me, but the Defense Language School did. Because, you know, they cycle people through very quickly and you have to pass. And it's this whole thing with the Defense Language Institute. So they kept telling me, if you don't pass listening, we're going to kick you out. Da, 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 da. So I failed. I failed German.
Okay.
And then I'm like, what is going on with me? So I go get my hearing tested, right?
Okay.
Find out I'm partially deaf in my left ear and have hearing issues. So the reason I can't pass listening in German is because I can't hear.
Okay.
And I don't know, I'm sure you know the things that go along with hearing. It kind of makes you angry. It makes you anxious because you can't hear people. So they recycle me to another class now with hearing aids. So long story short, and I don't want to get into it too much, So I was assigned IRT at the embassy, the U.S. embassy in Berlin, and I go there and I visit, and I'm, you know, my mentor is going to be the Army attaché, and things are looking up. I'm doing very well in German, and then I get medically retired because I'm having some issues.
Okay.
And I don't really want to go into them too much.
But yeah.
But basically, it all comes to a point of contention that, you know, she can't pass the listening, and all these things start to happen. So then I become medically retired, right? Mm-hmm. And then that's kind of where my career starts, because I ended up going to the Berlin Embassy under a different program and working, because I'm like, if you're gonna kick me out of the military for the things that you caused me,
right.
then I am gonna go anyways.
Okay.
So I ended up going to the embassy in Berlin and working there, and to spend a year in Berlin, and that's a whole different story. But yeah, so then I ended up being medically retired at 10 years. I got 100% disability rating. And I'll let you tell, you know, that's kind of where it ended, my military career.
Right. So, no, I understand that too. I'm medically retired as well. I was medically retired 07 while I was still in medevac from Launchstool. At several surgeries, I understand, especially with my hearing too. I have that same issue. I have I don't really go into it as much, but I do have significant hearing loss in my ear because of a compression explosion, and then because also my eye, my retina, and my things are, I had detached retina and cornea, and I can't really, I have problems seeing out of one of my eyes, but you know, now I just see cracks. Like it's, you know, it's funny. Like I look up, like if you look up, it's like you see like a spider web. It's fucking weird. I don't know. But then I always like, I make jokes about it. I'm like, oh, that's great. You know, everyone, like I know when it's a clear day, cause like my fucking, I'm seeing all kinds of weird shit. But no, I empathize with you because I know the hearing is a big issue. Not just tinnitus, but in general, you know, it's great. It works because I don't have to listen to my wife most of the time. Like she can talk to me all the time and I'm like, this is fucking great. You keep talking like, oh yeah. And then, but then she realizes that I'm not paying attention because I actually just don't hear her. So, but my kids are somehow like, they have this decibel level, which is incredible. And, like I was telling you, I was day drinking the other day because of them. But they know how to absolutely, they could be, you know, fucking four floors down, I'm gonna hear those kids scream. So for whatever reason, I could hear certain things, but other things I can't hear you. So I empathize with you with the aggravation of the hearing issue. So we leave the Army. I didn't want to leave either. I thought I was a career soldier. I love the Army still to this day, even though it's got its fucking faults. I hate, you know, certain people that are in there, but I don't hate the organization, right? Because there's always going to be bad people and bad shit in bad places. That's just the way it is. Just like, you know, people can pick and choose who they don't like. I have the same thing. So I have no ill will towards the United States Army or the military. I think it's great and it's opened up a lot of doors for me. So then you fast forward, you're coming out of embassy in Berlin, and I would assume you're back in the United States. And then I see your you go to be a House Fellow, then a military fellow with the House of Representatives. Is that how that kind of works in that way, or?
Well, so I was getting my master's, had a hard time being on campus as an older veteran, did a year of my master's, then did Berlin to escape, came back, finished my master's, kind of, and then decided to move to DC.
Okay, and then what got you into the fact that you wanted to be on the Hill? I'm just curious.
Well, I felt that because of my experiences, I could bring something to the table that was a little bit outside the box. Okay. So again, I'm outside the box. And this is where I knew I wanted to be permanently. So I just up and moved. I'm like, here, DC, here I come.
Right.
I think I can contribute. I don't necessarily know how, but I'm going to try.
Okay. So that's, so, and then is that where, and then they were doing, you were the House Representatives, it looks like, for a period of time. And you were, just to give everybody, I'll give Lindsay her props. She was a member of the House Armed Services Committee, and she advised them on just military items and veterans, which is an important thing because we need more people like her in those roles because they've walked the walk. And I don't know if you're the same way. It drives me nuts. Okay, I know it's a necessary evil, but it drives me nuts when I have people who haven't served a day making policy decisions. And it fucking is insane. But I also understand that it's the nature of the beast, but it's more important. So Hill Vets is an interesting thing, but I'm going to take that out of it. It's more important that we have people who serve. Dan Crenshaw is a perfect example.
Love Dan Crenshaw. Love him. Follow him. Love him.
Same thing. Seth Moulton, Tulsi Gabbard. I see people like that.
Mike Gallagher.
And then we go, there's so many. We got Rob Johnson coming up. I think he's going to run. He's a double amputee Marine. I think he's going to be fantastic. Brian Mast, Tammy Duckworth. We can go down the list. The reason I think it's important, and those are people who serve at the top levels, right? These are people who serve in, you know, congressional positions in Senate, and they were in the House, obviously. I think it's more important because not rank and file, but advisors, because they need to lean in the ear of the people who make those decisions and be like, you know what? It's fucking wrong. And here's why. You know what I mean? And most people are, you know, they're not going to be held back. And I think it's important because in the end of the day, listen, we're trying to change the space in a certain manner, right? I know what my sector is. I'm not looking to change the world. I'm never going to be able to do that. And I don't expect to do that. But for me, I want to change it for the next generation, everybody else coming through. So we learn from our mistakes, right? I had a horrible transition. You know, I see it now, even with these young Joes, everybody's coming in and out. I hear more and more, which breaks my heart a little bit. And I think you're going to touch on this in Women's of War podcast. Just the unfortunate and terrible things that do happen with women in the service, you know, whether it's MST or if it's just absolute discrimination, things along those lines, passing over for promotion, whatever it is. And that's actually going to lead me to my one story, how I laugh at folks, because I'm like, you all, everyone wants to talk shit. You've already told the story. I mean, you're running goddamn security convoys in what is one of the worst times in Iraq history, and literally dodging what people don't realize are EFPs, or if they're just going to be daisy chains, you know, 155s or whatever the fuck it's going to be, things that will not only vaporize you, but kill everybody in your convoy in a second. Oh, and by the way, I had 9 IEDs go off on the stretch of fucking road to 10 clicks in the last 48 hours, right? So it's like, it's a must happen. So just to go into my story as to why I wanted to do the Women of War podcast, you're a perfect example as to why I think you're a great example and host. I had, I'll never forget it. 2003, we're in the invasion. We do a minimal pause, and we used to carry around, folding chairs. And in the folding chairs, we cut holes in the middle because we had to take, you know, we had to go to the bathroom and take a dump, right? So we'd put our poncho on, we'd go sit on the chair, right? Because we had a hole in it, our ass would hang through it. And then we would go to business, right? Whatever. So we paused on MSR Tampa. It was a weird time because, like, you know, we occupied both lanes, which was stupid tactically if you even think about it nowadays, but okay. We paused because we had to put a FARP in behind us, a forward air refueling point for the Cobra gunships, because we were with Task Force Tara with the Marines. And so we're ahead of them, we're establishing security. And I'm like, damn, it's kind of getting dusk out, you know what I mean? And like, we're MREs now, full cycle for months. And you know what I mean? When it hits, bro. There ain't nothing you're gonna do. God himself or herself ain't gonna make a difference. I can't stop what's about to happen, right? Not even the strongest person. So I'm like, oh shit. And I'm like, all right, I gotta go out there. And I'm like, where are they? They're like, whoa, they're out there. And they're literally, there's two chairs side by side. And there's, I don't know, a couple, maybe 100 feet. People swept it out already. It's off to the side on the dirt a little bit. I'm like, all right, here we go. So I'm out there. I go over. I plop myself down with my poncho. And I'm just like, all right, hurry up. I got to get this done. You know what I mean? Because we're in combat mode. All of a sudden, I hear this female voice. She's like, sir, you mind if I join you? And I'm like, go right ahead. And this female E6 sits down. I won't say her name, but she knows who she is. And we proceed to have what would be the most interesting conversation for probably 15 minutes. And when I tell you, she made sounds that I couldn't even attempt to make that come out of her. Not a care in the fucking world. Not a care in the world. We're talking about all kinds of dumb shit. And she is, she's also got MRE gut, right? But that was the beauty of that moment. And then she finishes, we're both in our poncho. We're literally, I mean, our legs are touching, right? That's how close we were because we had it set up. And they said tactically put them together. I don't know what the whole point of it was, but literally we're next to each other. And we're not going into a bucket. Like, it's just like thing or whatever. It smells terrible, but we've also been in mop gear for fucking 3 weeks now. Everyone's disgusting. And yeah, no, we finished our conversation. She goes, you know what, sir? I'm good. Have a great day. Good luck. I'll see you next time. I'm like, great. I was like, that's interesting. I pull up, I finish up, and then I roll the fuck out. But that's just a good example of why I think it's important is that we were in, and those are the funny things that I remember. She pulled her weight, staff sergeant. She was in fights. She was in all kinds of shit. This was early conventional type of warfare. But we never had that issue. There was no like, oh my God, there's this girl sitting next to me and I got to take a shit. You know what I mean? Like, she came fucking just kicked that door in and just sat down next to me and we just fucking just talked while she ripped some of the most incredible ass you can imagine for probably 15 minutes. So I guess the point of all of it is that, yeah, it may not be for everybody and civilians might want to just try to dictate policy and everyone's got some of the czar agenda because they have no idea what it's like. But I think it's important now more than ever that we bring to the forefront these stories of women that deal with all different types of things in the military, because It's guys, to all you old thinking weirdos out there, and they call them boomers, whatever the fuck they're calling them nowadays, and everybody else and these Cold War fucks that are still around or trying to influence it. Women are not going anywhere. They're going to continue to fight. They've been doing it in Israel for a long time and every other country out there, and they're on the front lines all the time. And we need to cut the shit, all right? That's it. End of story. There's no pun there about me shitting with the chick like that, but we need to cut the shit. We need to have real talk, which is, I think you're perfect for it because of your background and you've walked the walk significantly. And I think it's important that you get out those hard to talk about subjects, because I think the more we bring attention to it, whether it's MST, whether it's discrimination, whether it's how women act in the service, how people perceive them, I think it's the only way we're going to start to change people's minds.
Or also talking about positive stories about having male leadership that was amazing and having people that were good leaders and then having the scumbags. It's a mix of both, like telling both sides of the story or telling all the stories.
You know, that's a good point too, right? And I shouldn't keep it all negative. I think that's why you bring a great point. I think we need to highlight that too. There's always, these need to be the people of record, right? I had a great lieutenant colonel that shepherded me through. I had shit ones that worked the fucking goddamn air that they breathe and steal from me every day. But I had great people in my life that I look back, male, female, that you're right, were great leaders, and we need to learn from them too.
Well, and I also think it's important too, when these women tell their stories, to look at what they're doing now.
Yeah.
Because a lot of them have, from what I've seen, have transitioned to things that they were very passionate about in the military, but they've now worked on the civilian side and they have less limitations, so they can really drive this mission home, whatever that topic may be. And then also to look at stories where women aren't doing that well. They're not transitioning well. They still have PTSD. They're trying to get their iPad so they can do teleconference health.
Okay.
There's a lot of other issues that I think we need to look at. Love success stories. They're always great. We can tell them all day long. But I think looking at this podcast, we need to look at what else is going on too.
And I think that you hit it right on the head. Not everything is sunshine and rainbows. And we're not going to, but part of it is, but I think the good mix will expose the good and the bad. And that's why, again, ladies and gentlemen, Lindsay Rowland is going to be fantastic to lead this effort. I think it's better that there's a lot of women podcasts getting out there. I love some of the things that Lieutenant Colonel Nunn's doing through Soldier for Life. I also think they're a little bit censored, right? Because they're from a government agency. I understand that. I think with you, you have such a latitude here to talk about real issues. Which I think is important because, and you know this, it's like the sunflower effect, I call it, right? On the bottom is all shit, but on the top, people are like, yay, it's rosy and everything's great. And I get all these people I served and I was a leader and all that stuff. And this, that's great. Let's talk about the problems that exist so the younger ones coming up and the next ones that we can address and fix it, because we want, I know there's particular things right now that individuals that we know have issues, like the issue with a friend of ours with the secretary of the VA. We won't go into who that is, but things like that where they have to understand that it's okay to talk about that bad things do happen and they shouldn't be afraid. And I think the bigger, the more platforms people get, the better an open and honest feedback they can get, the more we can help them.
Yeah, that person you're talking about, we actually have her on a podcast.
Okay.
So it'll be interesting.
I didn't want to say anything.
And also one other point I want to bring up is for this podcast, I would really like to also have males on the show, because it's important that we include males in this conversation. And I'm not saying every podcast, but we bring males into this conversation. I have my old brigade commander, I have some of my soldiers, and they can also talk on women in combat and their admiration. I don't want to narrow this down to just women being on the podcast, because this is a story that we need to tell, that it's everyone's story.
So I will tell you this much. I have one I'll pass to you right away. Rich High, as you might know, Angry Cops, Rich High. And people see his videos all the time. He's a, Mr. YouTube star. He's a drill sergeant. He's a police officer. But he is one of the more articulate and well-viewed individuals. And the first thing he said to me when we talked about doing this, because we just interviewed him the other day, He said, I want to be on the Women of War podcast because he's like, I want to talk about my experience. Because he said, I train all of them because I go from every perspective, you know, from a low, when I was a lower NCO to now when I'm a drill sergeant. He goes, I see it and I live it. And I've been to war with women. He goes, I want people to see that perspective. So I'll connect everybody after this, but I think that's a great one. And Rich, you're going to get your wish because I know you sent me that email and you're going to watch that you wanted to be on there. I'll make sure you and Lindsay connect and everybody can talk.
Come on, Rich, let's do it.
That's right, Rich. And she's going. So you're going to have your hands full. I'm excited. Anything else that you, as we're finishing up here, do you have anything else you want to kind of add to?
I'm just really excited to do this podcast. I'm grateful for the opportunity and the platform, and I look for great things to happen with this podcast. And just in general, I'm very excited.
Great. Well, ladies and gentlemen, the incredible Lindsay Rowland, the Women of War podcast host, and among all the other things out there, I do want to thank you for your time today and some of the great stories that you told. And, you know, we'll get this thing up and running, and we look forward to seeing you shortly.
All right, thank you so much. Okay.